All right, good afternoon, everyone. It's 1:30, so I'd like to call the meeting to order. I see 33 participants, but I also see a lot of people with their video off, so I'm hoping that everyone is there. So please bear with me. As is our custom, I need to read the guidelines that go with an electronic meeting. So in accordance with state law regarding public meetings held via electronic equipment, this meeting will be recorded and the recording will be posted on the authority's website. There's no public comment on today's agenda. Therefore, members of the public will not be permitted to speak during the meeting with the exception of the authority's consultants and professionals. In accordance with the governor's executive order regarding public meetings held via teleconference, board members and consultants and professionals are asked to state their name and title before speaking. Votes must be taken by roll call unless the vote is unanimous. And in the event the meeting is interrupted due to technical difficulties, members and staff will receive an email or text advising whether, number one, the meeting is adjourned or canceled, or number two, the time the meeting will resume. So with that as our preamble, I'd like to start with our roll call. When I call your name, please indicate that you are on the call. Okay, so beginning, Peter Lisi, board chair, obviously present. Other board members, Michael Angelini?
Present.
Thank you. Lawrence Davis? Lawrence Davis? Not yet. Steve Elbaum?
Good afternoon, Peter, how you doing?
Thank you, Steve. Daryl Hill?
Present.
Susan Martin?
Present.
And a few people whose name I'm going to call, but I believe they are not attending. Kimberly Kennison? Not present. Alan Matamana? Not present. And Mark Vahalak? Okay, not present. Lawrence Davis, one more shout out for Lawrence.
Peter, I'm here, thank you.
Great, thank you, Lawrence. Okay, let's move over to Chief of Staff, Jeanette Weldon.
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. Denise Aguilera.
Here.
Dan Junji.
Present.
Josh Herlock.
Here.
Bob Jandrow.
Present.
Krista Johnson. Krista Johnson.
You won't be here, Peter.
Okay. Dan Kurowski.
Present.
Carly Levin?
Present.
Joanne Makowitz?
Present.
Michael Morris?
Present.
Marlene Pagan?
Here.
Cynthia Peoples?
I'm present.
Julia Polano?
Here.
Thank you. Kara Stewart?
Here.
And Betty Sugarman Weintraub?
Present.
And Rebecca Ablett?
Here.
Thank you. Let's move over to our consultants and vendors. If I call your company's name, please indicate, state your name, that you are present. Anyone from Acacia Financial?
Josh Nicotown, Shelby Lovitz.
Thank you. Carmody Torrance?
Ann Zucker is here.
Thank you, Ann. Dave Pitney? Anyone from Dave Pitney? Okay. Anyone from Hardwick Law Firm?
Debbie Henry.
Thank you. Hawkins, Delafield, and Wood. Anyone? Hawkins, Delafield? No. Hinckley Allen.
I'm Marion here.
Thank you. McCarter and English.
Hi, Jane Warren.
Thank you. Oppenheimer.
Yes, Scott Gibson.
Thank you, Scott.
Liz is here.
Okay. Public Financial Management, PFM.
Trina Smith.
Thank you. Pullman and Conley.
Good afternoon, Eric Russell.
Thank you. Robinson and Cole.
Yes, Ed Samarychik is here.
And Shipman, a good one.
Aaron Levy is here.
Thank you. We have a couple additional guests. Anyone from Whittlesey?
Yep, Chris Wisniewski is here, cybersecurity.
Thank you. And the folks from Hopkins School or the University of Hartford on yet?
Peter, Mike, hi. Are they Edward, it's nice to see you again. You look great.
Retirement will do that, Greg.
You're getting younger looking. It's very impressive.
My handicap is still pretty high. Anyone else? Okay. Roll call is complete. Thank you.
Yeah, Peter, Laura Whitney, our CFO, is here.
Laura, are you on?
Yep. Hi, Peter.
Okay. Thank you. And anyone from Hopkins School?
No, I don't think anybody's joining from Hopkins, Peter.
Okay. Thank you. All right. So with the roll call complete, first item of business are the minutes from our May 18th meeting. I'm hoping that people have had a chance to review them. I'd entertain a motion to accept the minutes.
I'll make a motion to accept the minutes, Peter. Steve Albon.
Thank you, Steve. Is there a second?
Second from Mike Angelini.
Okay, the motion's been made and seconded to accept the minutes as presented for the May 18th meeting. Are there any corrections, edits, comments? Hearing none, all those in favor of accepting the minutes as presented, please say aye.
Aye.
Is there anyone opposed? Are there any abstentions? Thank you, the motion
Peter,
carries.
Peter, this is Lawrence. Peter, Lawrence. This is Lawrence, I'm abstaining. I was
okay.
Not present.
Thank you. One abstention, Lawrence Davis. Okay, before we get into the next item of business, just for the record, I do want to make sure, I know our board members are aware of this, but to the extent we have attorneys, consultant vendors on as well, I want to make sure everyone is aware of the very unfortunate news of Mark Pahalik's wife. Mark's wife had been battling cancer for quite some time. Unfortunately, she passed away at the end of May, and a notice was sent out to the board. But again, to the extent that we have attorneys, vendors, consultants attending the meetings who may have interacted with Mark, I wanted to make sure everyone was aware of it. Mark has been absent from the chief of meetings for a couple of months, and I foresee he will be for a few more months. But in the event that you'd like to reach out to him, I wanted to make sure, again, people outside the board knew of his circumstances. So with that, there is one other bit of housekeeping. I think, Kara, would you like to introduce a new member of our staff before we get into the business items of the agenda?
Yeah, thanks, Peter. So we have Rebecca Ablett. She started May 23rd, and she's been a huge help so far. So we're really grateful to have her, and hopefully some people will get to meet her in person someday.
Thank you, Kara.
Thank you.
Okay, so moving along. As I think everyone knows, we have been, one of the focuses of the board has been board education and bringing speakers in front of the board to enlighten us on topical issues affecting our business. Today we have a gentleman from Whittlesey, and I will turn it over to Cynthia to make the introduction. Our speaker will talk to us on cybersecurity. Cynthia, would you like to do the introduction?
Sure, very quickly. We have Chris Wisniewski from Whittlesey, who is our new auditor for the fiscal 2022 year for our financial statements. And Chris is going to provide us with, as Peter mentioned, education around cybersecurity, which I believe was requested by the board when we brought them on to engage with them for our new financial statements. So please welcome Chris Wisniewski, and I'll let him take it away.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for giving me a few minutes just to kind of throw a bunch of cybersecurity at you. I know that in a matter of 10, 12 minutes, there's a lot to cover. So I'll try and keep this at like a 50,000 foot level. But it's more of just to make sure you're aware. It's not to scare anybody. I think everybody understands at this point that cybersecurity is in our face. It's just nonstop. You probably only see or read about 3% of it. There are breaches, hundreds of breaches every day, constant. We just hear about the big ones. And the big concern is the highest target is going towards kind of a little shift. It was towards nonprofits. There was about 50 to 60% of the attacks were towards nonprofits in 2020, 21. Now we're seeing them towards municipalities, schools. So, you know, the trends are there, but it doesn't mean that, you know, everybody can just ignore it and we're resilient to it, right? So I don't know if we want to just shoot to the next slide. This is just an intro slide. So, you know, just a couple of things here that we can talk about. I think the biggest thing to make people aware is, sadly enough, that most of these breaches are still due to human error. We get the phishing attempts. Again, phishing emails are those emails that look real but aren't really coming from your CEO or your HR. You know, they've taken an approach to dupe you into giving up your credentials so that they can steal it and log in and do what they need to do. And that's how we get to those ransomware attacks. But what we're seeing is there's still a very large amount of employers that aren't doing security awareness training, which in this day and age is a little surprising just because of the amount of phishing attacks that happen. And really that's what's going to kind of help defend against that. You can have all the firewalls, you can have all these perimeter walls in place that are going to protect you. But at the end of the day, I have a little different approach. A lot of people say your employees are the last line of defense. Absolutely not. Your employees are the first line of defense. They're the ones that are going to be triggered into, you know, recognizing something or saying, hey, that doesn't look right. Something doesn't smell right here. So educating people and getting them up to speed and creating that culture. One thing I want to really point out is some companies kind of scare their employees into, if you click on this, you're going to be in trouble. No one's going to report a phishing attempt, even if they accidentally clicked on it. Those things happen. Nobody's, you know, 0% not at fault. So we try and, you know, foster that culture of it's okay. You know, the more you tell us, the better off we are. So one of the big things that, you know, I point down there in that fifth bullet is since COVID, we're looking at attacks from phishing have gone up 667%. So an absolutely insane increase. With that, we are starting to see a higher amount of ransomware. And for those of you if maybe not familiar, ransomware is where they come into your system and they'll encrypt your files and they basically hold it hostage. So they tell you the only way you're going to get those back is by, you know, paying us a certain amount of Bitcoin. And yes, it can be negotiated, but really, you know, we find that a lot of people won't pay it and shouldn't. What you really want to look at is your good backup systems. That's kind of where you're going to save yourself is with a very solid backup solution. You know, these full image backups that are offsite and offline, they can't be touched from the ransomware. You can recover quickly. You can ignore, you know, paying those or negotiating and leave it up to cybersecurity experts to really look at it and find out how it happened and then button the holes up. You know, how do we avoid this from happening again? So, you know, we look at things like that. One other point before we move on is we're seeing a larger increase in attacks on phones. I know everybody thinks if I have an iPhone, I'm stalwart. Not the case anymore, okay? People are writing code for every type of device. And because we're such a remote workforce now, specifically since COVID, we really are starting to see an increase in attacks on mobile devices. So it's important to approach that from a organization and not ignore it because, you know, there's still folks that don't put a passcode on their phone, which is scary, but we allow them to access their email, their Office 365 right on their phone. Well, you know, that's a pretty good easy window right into maybe some company information that you have that really should not be shared. So just a couple statistics to point out. If you want to jump to the next screen. Like I said, ransomware, we're seeing very, very big uptick. It's really what's taking that information, encrypting it, holding it hostage until you pay them. and again, really the best way to approach this is with those backup devices. So, you know, making sure that you have a solid backup program is really the answer to this. There is a new approach, actually, what they're doing. And that is they're looking at, they're not actually taking your data hostage and encrypting it. They're actually grabbing your information and downloading it. And then they'll put it out in the dark web. So the dark web is where everybody makes their money. That's the bad place, right? That's where, you know, all of your information is sold. That's where all the bad stuff goes on. And, you know, that's what you need to be concerned about. What information do I have on the dark web? And there's dark web scans that could be run and ongoing for your organizations to make sure. And we've found that sometimes we're scanning and we let a company know, hey, there's this hacker saying they have this much data. And what they'll do is they'll upload a couple pieces of, you know, personally identifiable information or protected health information to prove that they have it. That's a little scarier approach because you can't really show if they have 300 gig of data or 2 megabytes. And so they're starting to take that approach that you're going to have to pay them because they're selling it on the dark web. And now they're proving we do have your information. And so, you know, a lot of people ask me, well, how can I really protect against ransomware? Again, if they're going to get in, it's usually through phishing. It's through a phishing email, educating your folks to be able to alert and determine what is a bad email. Is this coming from a bad actor? You know, why am I being asked by the CEO to order $1,200 in gift cards? Which you would think wouldn't happen anymore. It just happened last week. And this person did it out of pocket. You're not going to get that money back. So, you know, the bad actors, all they really want to do is get in your system. If they can get credentials in, they're going to traverse through the network, get what they want, and kind of proceed from there to gather whatever information or hold you hostage or download the all that data. So, you know, the ransomware is there. It's still a problem. It hasn't gone down. If you want to hop to the next slide. One of the things people always ask too is, I'm concerned about myself. Should I do online banking? Should I shop online? I'll be completely honest with you. This day and age, they're doing more of a spread or a shotgun approach. They're going to shoot it out to, you know, thousands of people and try and, you know, they win one or two, it's a win. A lot of hackers aren't really targeting you and I individually because on the dark web, my debit card's worth 25 cents. Okay. Your license, I think it's worth about $1 on the dark web. So, you know, once we get into things like, you know, you're looking at your passport, those are easily replicated, duplicated. So maybe $50, but your protected health information is a big concern because that kind of ties with you. That's your medical records. So as you can see, okay, you know, Cynthia is $1, Chris is $1. Well, if I can get 300,000 of those people at $1, much more lucrative. So they're going for companies and organizations and big attacks because that's where their money is going to go, not necessarily individually focused. So we're also seeing a reality because of the Russia and Ukraine incident going on, higher attacks from Russia, specifically on our infrastructure in the United States. It's already happened. It's already been successful multiple times. I won't get into what infrastructure has been affected, but I can just say from a fact and what we do on our end that it has been already successfully breached. And so, you know, there's concerns out there of where are we heading with this? How are we going to stop it? Are they just going towards government? No, they're not. They're going towards any information that is held by any organization, specifically small to medium-sized business. That is the hot topic right now because they realize they do have data, they have information, but small to medium-sized business may not have the capital or the money to be able to put these security controls in place. So it's easier for them to access it and get a bunch of data. And the repercussions on this isn't just financial. You know, we're watching companies shut their doors. We had a breach of a lawyer firm. So there was a lawyer, paralegal, and just their admin, three people. They've been in business for 30 plus years. From that small breach, just them, took them down for 5 days, but the cost out of pocket at the end of it ended up being in excess of almost $250,000. So, you know, there's a big effect, and most small, medium-sized businesses without cybersecurity insurance can't afford to pay that. And we're seeing companies go out of business because of it, usually small to medium size, and it's very troubling. So, you know, we look at this whole approach. There are no federal laws that kind of cover everything. It's state privacy laws go state by state. And so, you know, Connecticut just did one of the most aggressive privacy acts that, passed in October of last year. And so there's kind of a safe harbor law that if you're doing certain things, you could be exempt from some punitive lawsuits. If you're doing a written information security program, you're doing security awareness. So they're actually rewarding companies for taking proactive steps. And you know, unfortunately, we shouldn't just be looking at this as, you know, what am I required to do? It's at this point, it's just best practice, you know? So why don't we go to the next slide? For purpose of time, remote workforce, that's the big one, right? Now that a lot of people have worked to maybe a hybrid model, not everybody's in the office, maybe some people are still remote, we're allowing people to use their personal laptops, or they took a laptop 3 years old from work, that's all we had to give them. Are they using a VPN to ensure there's a secure tunnel so when they're working, it's encrypted? Are we allowing people to just connect up to a Wi-Fi when you're out at Starbucks or Target or, you know, wherever you may be? That's like an actual no-no. I would never in my life connect to any free Wi-Fi because it could be very easily duped and people sniff the traffic and pull down information. It's not encrypted. It's not safe. So in those cases, that's where we say, if you're really going to do it, you got to have a VPN that you offer to your employees that they have to connect first prior to doing work. The big thing these days, I don't know, you know, how many organizations, you know, we used to get a lot of pushback, but two-factor authentication, meaning when I log into even my office email, I'm, you know, prompted with a second factor of authentication. It may be a text, it may be a phone call, it may be a pop-up from like a Duo third-party app that I hit approve. So, you know, those are the things, having that two-factor, we see stop probably 90% of attacks, because maybe the attacker has your credentials, but they don't have your phone to approve that next layer. So it's really critical to have that in place and use that as a stopgap. If you want to go to the next page. So, you know, this is just one of those kind of, as we wrap up, what are best practices? This day and age, yes, it is required by certain regulatory. I don't want to get into the weeds. Cybersecurity and IT risk assessments, you got to do them annually. You don't know your risk unless you really look at it. And doing these so much, and this is not that Whittlesey has to do it, you can consult with anybody, just as long as you're doing, you'd be amazed at how many people we get pushback of, we're fine, we don't have anything, give me an hour of scanning your system, we'll come up with, you know, 50, 60, 70 findings in 1 hour. You really need to know what you have. The other important thing about that is, with the cybersecurity insurance, you're going to find that you're going to be required heavily to provide evidence of what you're doing for security controls. They're becoming much more strict because premiums are going up. Some of your bigger ones, Travelers, Hartford Steam Boiler, you know, they're requiring multi-factor authentication. And if not, they won't give you insurance. We've seen carriers drop clients that they've been with because they're not taking security controls. So things like these cybersecurity assessments, the multi-factor, using email encryption, you can enable that right in Microsoft or Google. The other thing is, when you're sharing information, using a secure protocol. So something like a share file. People like to use Dropbox, not the most secure, but you could use File Genius, things like that that are approved that will cover, you know, like a DFARS for government or HIPAA or anything GLBA approved. And then we look at vendor management. You need to know what your vendors are doing. You need to know, are they taking security protocols? Even Microsoft, they're holding your email. They're hosting it. It's out of your control. So you need to be looking at those reports that they give out every year. It's called a SOC report. What are they doing to control? Do they have deficiencies? Because by rights, if they have that SOC audit done, it's an attestation, they will go ahead and they will have to reveal if there are any security holes. And that's open to the public. And then in that report is what they call an end user consideration, meaning you as the organization need to be doing X, Y, and Z to kind of comply with what their security standards are. So I know I probably just threw a huge amount of information at you. I am going to just say, Cynthia, if you even want to share these slides with those folks on the phone, I'm completely fine with that, just so you have some information. You guys can certainly follow up with me if you have questions. We're here as a resource. But are there any questions? I guess I'll open that up.
Questions? Chris, this is Peter Lisi. Just a real quick one. On one of your slides, I think it was the ransomware, the very last bullet was double tap ransom. I'm not sure I'm familiar with that.
Which slide are we at?
Maybe slide four. Five or have you were talking about ransomware?
Let's see if we pull that up. Yes. So
yeah, right there, double tap. What's that about?
Yep. So you basically take it from they've moved from targeting just single endpoints. That they'll go a little more sophisticated. So when we talk about, they had different industries that they would look at. They'll steal sensitive data before encrypting the network. So that's kind of what I talked about is the double tap is before we encrypt it and use the ransomware, we actually download everything. And then they throw it out on the dark web so they can prove to you. So basically they're stealing the data and they're encrypting it. So they kind of nail you twice. So that's the double tap approach. Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
It was very interesting and a little bit scary, or maybe a lot scary, but very sobering.
It is sobering.
Any other questions for Chris? Anything else?
Right. Well, thank you guys. I appreciate
Chris, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much. You guys have a great day. Everybody be safe.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, I'm not sure who it was, Cynthia or Jeanette, but thank you for arranging that. It, as I said, it was certainly a very sobering presentation. Okay.
Cynthia arranged it.
Thank you, Cynthia. I will say I just got back from traveling for a few days and I used the free Wi-Fi at the hotel. And now I'm a little concerned that probably the worst thing I could have done, but we'll let that go. All right, let's move into our reports. Jeanette, would you like to start with the authority update?
Yes, I just had two things I wanted to mention. One is yesterday, Cheswell closed on a $75 million transaction. It was taxable and tax exempt, including the taxable piece was an advance refunding piece. It was done to release some trapped equity, which will be beneficial for Cheswell. And luckily, the bonds were sold on May 19th, which was really at the beginning of this period of Fed rate hikes. So we feel like we were lucky with regard to the timing. And Josh will be providing some additional Cheswell updates in a few minutes, but did just want to mention the new loan rate is 5.49%, which is an increase over our prior rate of 4.59, but it compares quite favorably to the Federal Plus loan rate just reset at 7.5%. So we're really comparing quite well to that. And then the second thing I wanted to mention is in your board packet, there is a blog post for the on the site of the Center for Effective Philanthropy that was written by Betty that speaks to CHIFA's capital grant funding. So just wanted to encourage people to take a look at that if you have a chance. And that's all I had for authority updates.
Thank you, Jen. Any questions? Okay, Michael?
Oh, sure, Peter. On the financing forecast, we have new financing for the Area Collaborative Educational Services, otherwise known as ACES. You may remember they did a bond issue with us last year. They're going to be purchasing another school, which they currently lease in Hamden. Key Bank will be the purchaser. for the $12.8 million transaction. It will be a private placement. And we're looking to price four remarketings for Yale University totaling over $420 million. At the end of the month, which will close on July 1, we have a closing for the Village and Families and Children tomorrow. That's $14.1 million, half of which is new money. And Yale New Haven Health will be paying off their 2012 Bridgeport Hospital issue on July 1st, which is over a little more than $10 million. And I let Mr. Angelini know that we really don't encourage borrowers paying off early, but it'll save them money, I guess.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael. Any questions? All right. Thank you, Mike. Joanne, financial report.
All right, thank you. For the 10 months ended April 30th, 2022, our revenues exceed expenses by $3.1 million before program expenses and $1.1 million after program expenses. Our revenues are over budget by $74,000 and our expenses are under budget by $101,000. Really nothing notable happened in April.
Okay.
That's all I have.
Thank you. Any questions on the financials for Joanne? Okay, great. Moving right along.
Thank you.
Cynthia, you must have some interesting things to report. The interest rate market has been quite interesting.
Well, I can't be a morning Joe, but just some very quick highlights. Related to the volatility in the markets. Obviously, we have over 8.5% of soaring inflation year over year. The Fed is expected to do something any minute now with this, as far as the benchmark rate is concerned, and possibly increasing that by 0.75%. Even though there's been talk of doing consecutive 50 basis points increases over time, obviously to tame inflation. One of the things that, I wanted to mention was that a lot of the gains that we've had over the last 17 months in the stock market have been lost as of today. But in morning trading, the NASDAQ and the S&P have risen some fraction of a percent so far. And the last thing I just wanted to talk about was just the yield curve in general. Today versus June of last year and June of 2020. And the fact that it's very steep right now. The 3 month rate is 1.775. The 10 year is 3.393. The 30 year is 3.388. So it drops off just a little bit there from between 10 and 30. So it's a very steep yield curve right now as compared to the last two Junes from 2020 and 2021 that was inverted. Just something to note in the volatility of what's going on today, as opposed to the position that we were in just 2 years ago. So.
Thank you, Cynthia. Any questions? All right, moving along. Bob, market update.
Yeah, hi, Peter. The municipal market continues to be subject to large swings in volatility, as we've kind of talked about. Whether it's rising interest rates, rising inflation, Federal Reserve monetary policy, as well as the equity market volatility. Municipal bond flows continue to experience outflows, which have resulted in further selling in the municipal markets. Thus far, there have been 22 consecutive weeks of outflows, bringing the year-to-date total to $68.7 billion, representing the second largest outflow cycle since the Davy Sarage began in 1992. Staff doesn't have anything to highlight on the transaction report, just given the fact that there's been a lack of reportable new issues in both the higher ed and health sectors.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. Any questions? Okay. Last update coming from Josh regarding Chesla.
Thanks, Peter. I'm just going to share my screen quick. I have a quick presentation. Okay, so for Chesil's in-school loan volume, We've dispersed $15.8 million through quarter three of fiscal 22. This represents a 10% decline from fiscal 21. I would also like to point out there's no debt service issues. As Jeanette just mentioned, we just completed our new bond deal and new cash flows were run at that time. So we're fine there. Moving to the next slide, our refinance loan volume. We've dispersed about $2 million through quarter three, which represents a $1 million or 94% increase from fiscal 21. So while the in-school has seen a downturn, we're happy with the progress of the refi program. Regarding our scholarship program, the application for students pursuing an undergraduate degree was open March 1st through May 1st. At the January Chesil board meeting, the board of directors approved an allocation of $470,000 for the undergraduate scholarships. At our Chesil board meeting later this week on the 17th, we will be proposing to award 171 recipients for a total of $489,000. This is because we have some excess left in our scholarship account due to refunds over the years and changes in student enrollment. As a reminder, those undergraduate degree awards are $3,000 for a full-time student and $1,500 for a half-time student. Regarding the certificate program scholarships, again, these are on a first-come, first-served basis. Those awards are $1,250. For fiscal 22, we dispersed all of our certificate scholarships, which was 24, totaling $30,000. The application for 22-23 will reopen on July 1st. And again, that allocation is also $30,000 again this year. Lastly, I just had some marketing highlights. We're pretty happy to be back to some in-person events. We had a college fair in Bridgeport on April 12th, a college fair on May 15th, which was held in Farmington, with over 15 towns attending. Chesil presented at the annual guidance symposium that was held at the Hartford Club on May 18th. And we were also present at the Money Madness Conference and the Fox Student News Awards on June 1st. Regarding our high school outreach program, we contacted over 150 high schools across the state. In 2022 thus far, we've hosted 5 presentations. And we also have 2 scheduled for the fall. Those in the fall are Rocky Hill and Fairfield. So that's the end of my presentation. Are there any questions that I can answer?
Questions for Josh? Josh, this is Peter. I just have one quick one for you. On your outreach, where you say that Chesil contacted over 150 high schools, I'm assuming that's not in person. Is that like an email blast or what does a contact consist of?
So it's both. We sent emails to all the schools and then the Chesil staff, called each one of the schools throughout the state to try to garner their interest in the program. I think our goal in the next year is obviously to increase the utilization of the outreach.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Josh? Okay, thank you, Josh.
All right, thank you.
Okay, let's see, moving along. Got a preliminary memo. Mike, you can walk us through that? You're muted.
Sorry. Yes, for the Hopkins schools. They intend to issue up to $26 million as a public offering. Hopkins is a day school located in New Haven. It was founded over 360 years ago. It's the third oldest independent school in the U.S., and it enrolls just over 700 students. Proceeds will be used to finance the construction of a new academic and performing arts center and refi 2 of their bond issues, totaling about $9.4 million, but that will depend on market conditions. The school is currently rated AA minus by S&P. It was last affirmed in May and most likely will retain that rating for this bond issue. It'll be a 30-year fixed rate secured by a pledge of demand profile is very strong with steady enrollment over the past 5 years at the school's desired full enrollment level. They have very favorable matriculation rates and a strong student quality. Selectivity has fluctuated between 40 and 50%, and that's the result of a steady decline in applications since 2020. Fall 2022 numbers are better, but we'll have a better idea when we bring it back next month. Operating performance has been very impressive with strong operating and operating cash flow margins over the past 5 years with good net tuition growth and low tuition discounting. Although management states that they plan to slowly increase the discount rate. S&P did comment the school has limited revenue diversity with a high dependence on tuition and fees of over 80% for 2021, which compares unfavorably to S&P median of 63.5%. But I think that's pretty typical of day schools to have a high tuition dependence. The financial resources are also strong. They have cash and investments of $213 million to provide ample cushion for pro forma debt and 2021 operating expenses. And with the $16 million of additional debt, debt service will be continuing to be very manageable with a low debt service burden of approximately 3% and strong pro forma debt service coverage. Although the average age of the plant is slightly high of 15.5 years, but this will be addressed with future fundraising initiatives to bring that down. So that's that. We're planning on bringing this back next month for approval.
Okay. Any questions? Mike, did you say that this was going to be a public offering?
Public offering, yes.
It is? Okay. All right, final memo next month. Any questions? All right. Thank you, Mike. Bob, do I talk to us about LiveWell?
Peter, if I may, could I please request that we move the University of Hartford transaction prior to LiveWell, just out of respect for the guest time?
Absolutely. Happy to flip-flop it.
And Peter, on that note, I'm going to have to recuse myself, as I mentioned, on the University of Hartford.
Yes. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. So the University of Hartford has been in the midst of change essentially since 2017, when they brought in a new president, a new vice president of marketing and enrollment, and a newly appointed vice president of finance and operations. In 2019, you may recall that the university received a CHIFA approval of up to $150 million, which included plans to refinance all the university's outstanding privately placed debt and to finance the construction of a new academic building and various other capital improvements on the campus. At that time, staff noted the university's challenges of deteriorating operating performance, weak matriculation, but we also based our recommendation at the time on the benefits gained from the elimination of put-related risk as well as interest rate risk. And the restructuring of debt service that existed through 2049. We were encouraged, however, by the prospect of a new academic building, which would house a new nursing program as well as the engineering school, and the prospects of a bold strategic plan that was nearing its final stages of completion. Included in your memo last month, staff provided a brief summary of the university's strategic plan, which is expected to be carried out over a five-year period and run in tandem with a financial stability plan. In staff's viewpoint, these two plans, in combination with all the other undertakings the university has already implemented, such as new leadership, new academic buildings, renovations and additions to existing buildings, new programs, new majors, and initiatives meant to increase the student experience. Additionally, these initiatives are meant to beautify the campus, bringing it to a similar level of competing universities. thereby it puts the university in a better position from which to compete for prospective students. Coupled with the addition of new programs and majors, which we talked about, enhancing the student experience, this should all translate into greater brand identity for the university, allowing it, again, to attract new students, to grow enrollment, to increase retention, and put the university in a much improved position financially to operate. I do want to highlight in the memo, there is one error that we were made aware of this morning. On the page 3 of the memo, or page 83 of the packet, the liquidity covenant should read that the institution shall maintain a ratio of cash and investments to debt of at least 50%, and not what we have listed with the unrestricted net assets to total debt of at least 20%. So staff's recommendation is contingent upon the university's ability to maintain and obtain an updated credit rating of BBB- from Standard & Poor's, which is expected to occur in the next 2 weeks. Therefore, we please request the board's approval today based on this contingency of up to $25.5 million to finance various other capital projects, including the renovation of the university's largest residential community, housing up to 900 students, a new outdoor track, health and wellness center. It's important to note the university is fundraising to help offset costs of the project, and has been successful in the past in fundraising efforts. The university has secured approximately $13 million of a $20 million goal towards projects, and is in the process of evaluating a new campaign, a comprehensive capital campaign. And that's pretty much what I have for right now. So I will open it up to questions, and I'll certainly have our guests from the university speak if they so wish.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. Before we get to a discussion, let's get the motion out there. Is there a motion to accept staff's recommendation for the financing for the University of Hartford? Is there a motion?
It's Mike Angelini.
This is Lawrence. I'll move.
All right, Lawrence moved it. Mike seconded it. Happy to open the floor up to any questions, discussion, comments, anyone?
It's Daryl, just one. Bob, you mentioned the correction in the memo. I think it was page 383 of the PDF. I didn't see it there. Is it page 6, page 86 of the PDF where the liquidity is discussed?
It should be under financial covenants on page 83 of the board packet.
The debt service coverage ratio?
Below that, yeah. So we have below the debt service coverage ratio, we have minimum unrestricted net assets to total debt of at least 20%. That should read cash and investments to debt of at least 50%.
50, okay, thank you.
Yep.
Peter, I'm not sure, this is Greg Woodward, what my role here is, but if you'd like me to give a little bit of some updated numbers or figures of where we stand at the moment, I'd be happy to do that.
Sure. I think any information would be welcome. Sure.
That'd be great. Thanks so much for inviting Laura and myself to the meeting. And thanks for your, continued hard work for the educational, efforts of the state of Connecticut. I think it's commendable that all of you do this, and really appreciate your efforts. I will say that we've made some hard decisions over the last 3 or 4 years at the university, all in favor of a couple key items. One is the success of our students. And a lot of those choices were made around increasing retention, which we did raise from 73 to 81%, which is a rather remarkable change in a 3-year period before the pandemic struck, including the same exact level of change for students of color, which comprised 41% of our student body. that population raised their retention by 17%, which is a national success story. And we're very, very proud of that. And so we have better persistence, better graduation rates, better retention. Those things will bounce back, certainly after the pandemic that caused those numbers to go down a little bit. Our investment in new academic programs has really borne fruit. All of the new programs, there's probably 10 that I could mention, are absolutely full with incoming students for this fall: nursing, occupational therapy, physical therapy, exercise and sports science, robotics, data analytics, business data analytics, computer science, different kinds of engineering programs, aerospace engineering. We're really looking to see what our students want, what their families want, what the society around us needs. And we've been able to put those programs in place, and they're very full, which is fantastic news. The addition of the Hersey Center, which is a $60 million academic center for education, nursing, health professions, computer science, engineering, and technology, has been a real boon to us. We are up in enrollment for the fall in both those two schools, the NHP and CETA, significantly. And so I feel that the numbers that we're seeing in our incoming class and profile really validate our choices. So we built a budget for next year based on 1,173 new students. We are today at almost exactly 100 students higher than that. We are at 1,262. Our admissions office thinks we may actually get to 1,300. So 1,262 compared to 1,173, we are up 90 students exactly in our budget projections, in our actual reality compared to our budget projections. We also are up in on-campus student housing applications to about 2,550. Our budget was based on 2,400. So we're over 100 students there. 100 students at about $10,000 net revenue per student is $1 million. 100 students in enrollment is about 23,000 net revenue per student, about $2.3 million. And so we're looking at a good $3 million plus positive set of data points right now and looking at our fall, which is really great news. We're really excited about that, obviously. It shows that we've made good choices, are doing the right thing. I did create this financial sustainability plan for the board and for the campus this past summer, and it was ratified this spring by the board, and includes three categories: investments for revenue, investments for added value, and cost savings options. And there's about 16 or 17 different items on there. We are increasing our shop and our efforts around online learning, which has been growing by 20% a year. Our graduate professional population is growing rapidly, which is great. We're kind of losing some consultants that cost us $1 million a year and putting in people in our own shop in place to replicate those efforts at a much cheaper rate. In fact, at half the rate that we spend for the consultants. And those numbers will continue to grow, which is quite exciting. I will say also that I know it's a delicate topic for some people, and it has been a volatile topic in the news. There is a small group of very unhappy people that support Division I athletics at the University of Hartford, based upon several years of negative end of year budgets. And looking at the return and investment in Division I athletics, the board decided to go to Division III. It'll take 3 years of classes of incoming athletes to see the full power and potential of that change. But let me just highlight for you quickly that our 325 Division I athletes at a 95% discount rate brought the university about $1.5 million a year. 400 athletes at the Division III level, which is a very conservative number, at the normal discount rate of about 59%, brings the university an additional $10 to $12 million. So in cutting down the expense of athletics by half, a savings of about $4 million, and by increasing revenue to the tune of about $10 to $12 million, we're looking at a $15 million annual turnaround for the university by moving from Division I to Division III. I could go on for hours about how the board also feels that is a philosophical and mission-driven choice and not just a financial one, and that recreation, wellness, and athletics would be shared across the entire student body and not for a select few of admittedly very good students and very good athletes. So Good news here, validating again our choice, is that we have entering this fall 110 Division III student athletes at the normal discount rate. Is the largest athletic recruiting class in the history of the University of Hartford. And that comes at a time when we don't belong to a conference yet. We don't have coaches that are all necessarily on board with the change. And we haven't had much time to advertise or market this, but we have a 110 student athlete contingent entering this fall. Times four, that's 440 student athletes. We're adding men's and women's ice hockey, men's and women's tennis, and women's field hockey. That'll be another 100 student athletes. That takes us over 500 student athletes, meaning that our profit on that item alone in this financial sustainability plan is over $15 million annual turnaround. So I don't want to overemphasize the athletics. I just will say that inside this financial sustainability plan, that is the biggest and most powerful lever that we have in bringing the university into a financially sustainable and very, very powerful place. So we're moving some staff in different directions. We've done a couple of retirement programs. We've reduced our staff by about 72 people. We're reducing full-time faculty. We're adding new programs. And this particular bond issue is critical to our success because our deferred maintenance in our residence halls has really gotten to the point where it's not sustainable as a business proposition. The dorms are old, kind of falling apart. This $25.5 million will allow us to completely renovate over one third of our residence halls in the village apartments, over 900 beds. We renovated 20 of those beds last year, and now we have 880 left to go. As a result of that renovation, over 100 students more have signed on for campus housing for next year because they saw what the village apartments will look like. So we know it works. We know that the return on the investment will be sudden and quick and absolute. And it'll also put us in a more competitive posture with our peer institutions around the students' living conditions, which is where they spend most of their time, let's face it. So Peter knows our campus well, knows that those facilities needed an upgrade, and probably appreciates the fact that we are taking strong efforts to renovate them and to create better student living spaces. So between living and athletics and the new programs and the rising of enrollment, the university is in a very good place, very good looking future over the next couple of years. And I'm excited about the changes we put in place that are being validated by the numbers. So I'll stop there and see if there's questions later.
Greg, thank you very much. Very, very compelling and enthusiastic presentation. Thank you. Any questions for the president of the University of Hartford or Bob, or I believe we still have the CFO on the line. So any questions? Any questions at all?
Peter, this is Lawrence. I just wanted to say, I commend the university for the changes and the progress that it's made. Just wanted to see if someone can speak a little more about, add some detail and color about the fundraising that they're doing.
Thanks, Lawrence, for your kind words. I appreciate it. I'll speak quickly about fundraising, and then I'll turn to Laura for the S&P. We had a nice call with S&P this morning. I thought it went very well, as did they. We have $13 million in our pockets in promise money for student experience. So around recreation, wellness, and student living, the majority of that money comes from our food provider, Aramark. So we signed a 10-year contract with Aramark. They are giving us $1 million a year as gift money back for each of those years. We have negotiated with them to get about $3 million of that up front. We're negotiating to get another $4 to $5 million of that up front, by perhaps even extending our 10-year contract a little longer. If we do that, they'll kick in another $1 million a year. So that money could actually grow by $3 million more dollars over the next couple of weeks. We have a plan to raise $7 million for these projects. That will be, in my opinion, easy. We've been breaking records. We've broken this university records for fundraising the last 4 years in a row. We were able to raise $20 million for the Barney School renovation, the Center for Student Success, some additions to the Gengra Student Union, and of course for the Hersey Center. So $7 million is not a huge ask for our top-notch staff in institutional advancement. Many of you probably know Kate Pendergast and others. And so we have identified certain portions of the projects, like the track itself, some of the field events, perhaps some of the additions in the residence hall, which would include lounges and study areas. We have some people that want to contribute to batting cages and tennis centers. So we have a lot of action. We're just getting started with that. I have every single possible faith that we will be able to raise that $7 million pretty easily. So we'll be at $20 million or beyond in our fundraising for this group of projects. Just if you can put this in your head, it's about $20 million for the village apartments. It's about $8 million for a track and field. It's about $10 million in campus renovations. That's $38 million. We're asking for 25.5. We have 13 that we'll raise. If we can raise a little more to do some of the campus renovations, then that would be a good news. So I think we're in really good place there with, you know, 13 of the 20 million we hope to raise already in our pockets, and the other seven, I think, easily doable. So I'll defer to Laura now.
Ms. Lawrence, what was the specific question about S&P? You broke up a little bit.
I didn't ask about S&P. Just asked about the color in terms of what you were doing with regard to the fundraising, and you know, just asked for any details that could be provided. And I think that I've heard some very good stuff here. So I don't know if you have more to add, but I thank the president for what he shared.
Yeah, and I think one of the really great success stories at the university is the Hersey Center, where it was our largest gift from a living donor, and it also included a $2 million endowment to support future infrastructure investments in that building. And again, we're really trying to think a lot more strategically in our fundraising, and I think that's a really good example of it.
Yeah, outside of these projects, we're also redoing the Hillel Center and the Jenger Student Union, and we have over $1 million in gift for that project, and it's only a $500,000 project. And I'm going to, I know this sounds horrible, I'm going to go play Maidstone in the Hamptons, one of the great golf courses in America, on Friday to close another $1.5 million gift, which will be unrestricted money that we can put towards our career center, our Center for Student Success, or towards these projects. And we have another two really great donors in the seven figure range, which we're closing gifts on, but I just can't say more than that about it. So we're really, to be honest, we're really good at this. It's going well. We'll be able to raise the money. I think we'll actually end up with some extra money, which would be great. The next phase of all this building will be to fix the sports, to add, make an addition to the sports center itself in phase two. And that would be to add much more space for intramurals, club sports, recreation.
Well, don't forget to let your host win on Friday.
You know, it's funny, Peter, my experience is that when you play with avid golfers, they like playing with golfers that are better than them. It shows them off at their club. It makes them feel, you know, kind of proud and excited, like, hey, I brought this ringer over to my club. So you got to play it just right. You want to win by a little, but not too much.
No, I understand. I was just kidding. So are there questions? I have one for Laura, but I want to open up to anyone else if they have a question. Anyone? So Laura, you know, Greg provided a wonderfully, you know, concise and optimistic outlook for the university, and it seems like all the pieces are being put in place for success going forward. And I commend, you know, Greg and you and the senior team there for putting these pieces in place. So, but I guess I'm wondering then for S&P and the rating, they put a negative outlook. It's BBB-, but the outlook is negative. And that seems so in conflict with all the good things that are happening and, you know, the optimism that Greg is sharing and all. So could you talk a little bit about those conversations with the rating agency and how they landed on a negative outlook?
Absolutely. So I remember the day very clearly. It was just about the day we all went home for COVID. And, you know, so we had gotten our rating for Chief N in September of 2019, and then everybody went home in March of 2020. And S&P actually went out of their way to call me and explain what they were, you know, why they were doing it. It really was because of the pandemic. And I think, you know, one of the things that they said to me at the time was, we felt your excitement in September when we were there, and We understand that you're being, you know, that you're placing a focus on career-ready majors, and that, you know, that this is going to take a little bit of time to turn things around and to get the building built and to start the enrollment. So remember, we're seeing the success right now of an increase in enrollment. This is the first admission cycle where the Hersey Center was actually on the tour. So again, we're seeing that start to roll out, but right. I do remember the conversation very distinctly that it was around COVID. And we met with them this morning, and I'm really hoping to get that turned around.
Great. Thank you. So Bob, you were asking for a board approval, but you said it was contingent on what again?
Yeah, I'm receiving the BBB- rating from S&P.
With a stable outlook?
With negative is fine. I think we're just making sure that it doesn't dip below investment grade.
Okay, fine, thank you. Any other questions for Laura, Bob, or the president?
I'll just add in, Peter, that it's amazing to me. You know, people don't really quite see the higher education landscape around the pandemic. You know, we have almost 3,000 students living on campus, and we had to send them all home and all the money they paid with them. And that was, you know, a year and a half of brutal financials in the higher university arena. And we're rebounding really well from that. These things go into place. We will have positive, beautiful budgets, you know, for the next any number of years. And I feel really confident with S&P that they'll see that rebound and put us in a good place. So I really appreciate all your time and effort, everybody on the call. And thanks, Bob. And thank you, Peter, for considering us.
No, it's a wonderful story. And I think even though I'm retired, I still follow higher ed pretty closely. And what you've had to manage through during this pandemic, I wouldn't wish it on anyone. So congrats for the job you've done. So,
Peter, I would just note that with regards to that negative outlook that was placed by S&P, that it wasn't exclusive to only the University of Hartford. It was a broad-based action that they had taken on the sector in general.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to make you aware of that.
No, I appreciate that. And I guess, again, just reinforcing the point that it's been an incredibly difficult time for almost everyone in higher ed, and kudos to the university for managing its way through it and having a plan in place. So
yeah, we're going to come out with a plan to emerge stronger than before the pandemic. And that's actually coming true, which is really exciting. And, you know, it's taken a lot of courage to make some of these choices. And to be honest, I've taken a lot of personal abuse over them. But you got to do the right thing. And it's time to move forward and make the university, you know, a really great, beautiful, sustainable place. What a powerful entity it is in our community, right? 30% of our students come from Connecticut. 64% of our graduates stay, work, and live in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. It's 92% career success rate, 41% students of color, 38% Pell eligible. 43% of our students are first generation college students. It's a really inspiring and beautiful story.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Any other questions for Bob, Laura, or Greg? Anyone? Questions or comments? Okay. There's a motion made and it's been seconded to accept staff's recommendation for the financing of the University of Hartford contingent on the rating at BBB-, no lower than BBB-. Hearing no other questions, comments, or discussion, I'll call for a vote. All those in favor of the motion in support of staff's recommendation, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? And is there any abstentions? I know Steve has recused himself. Any abstentions? Hearing none, the motion carries. Thank you very much. Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Enjoy the week.
Thank you. Next order of business, next item of business is the financing for LiveWell Alliance. Bob, you want to walk us through it?
Sure. Yes. Okay. So last month, staff presented its credit review of LiveWell. We also talked about Hamlin Capital Management. We talked about, for all intents and purposes, that this transaction is very similar in structure to a non-rated privately placed direct purchase, but it's being conducted within a limited public offering framework. The decision to pursue a non-rated limited public offering versus a non-rated direct purchase was based upon the purchaser's requirement that a CUSIP be attached to the issued securities. The entire estimated par amount of $81.6 million of bonds to be issued will be sold directly to Hamlin Capital Management, whom staff made available at last month's meeting as well. Hamlin has agreed to execute an investor letter stipulating that they're an accredited investor, and essentially the responsibility for due diligence and credit review rests with Hamlin, despite this being a limited public offering. Staff would like to point out that from our perspective that LiveWell has exhibited good operating performance, which has resulted in surpluses from operations in each of the past 5 years. In addition, with over 30 years of experience, the organization exhibits a high level of adeptness within its specialty of dementia care. Every year, LiveWell is sought out by various other providers from across the country for their assistance in helping them to make improvements to services which they deliver. However, LiveWell is also faced with a few challenges, the first of which is securing approval for this transaction in order to move forward with our plan to convert from a mainly skilled nursing model to an assisted living care model. Following soon thereafter, there will be the completion of the construction project, the achievement of full capacity of the newly constructed units, and then the securing of a more permanent financing from this bridge-style financing. The project construction will commence in two phases, one of which began in April of 2022, and the second one began in May of 2022. It's expected that the newly constructed phase one units will be made available in June 2023, and that phase two units will be made available in December 2024. LiveWell anticipates achieving stabilized occupancy of the new units in September 2025. The feasibility study was conducted by the largest certified public accounting firm headquartered in the Southern United States. They're also the 17th largest in the United States. The feasibility study provides provides an opinion that the financial forecasts associated with the associated project and financing provides sufficient funds to meet LiveWell's operating expenses, working capital needs, and other financial requirements, including the debt service requirements. So staff would like to recommend the proposed financing based on the combination of first, Hamlin Capital Management's confidence, experience, and expertise in conducting due diligence and credit analysis for these kinds of strategic investments, as evidenced by their $81.6 million commitment of both client and management assets. In addition to LiveWell's ability to successfully operate in the area of dementia care, coupled with their $4.5 million equity contribution. And finally, based on the findings that the feasibility study provided, saying that, which supports the financial forecast of the project. That's it.
All right. Before we open up to questions, would someone like to get the motion on the floor for acceptance? Is there a motion made to accept staff's recommendation? Anyone?
So moved. This is Mike.
Thank you, Mike. Is there a second?
Peter, I'll second.
Thank you, Steve. All right. The motion has been made and seconded. I'd like to open up to any questions or comments. For Bob, any questions on LiveWell? Anyone? Just goes to show what I know. I thought this one was going to generate the questions.
Well, I think that, a lot of, what I would have thought was that, more discussion, would have been raised at, the preliminary meeting where we had, all available resources at hand. But I will also just say that, for the most part, as I mentioned at the very beginning, is that, this is very much in line with what we see when we are involved in direct private placement, direct purchases. I mean, this is all going to one investor. I think that LiveWell is, I'm not sure what happened to my lights, but you know, LiveWell does a great job operating in the space that it's in. I mean, they're one of the first, if not the first, in the space, operating in this area of specialty. So I'm certainly open to answer any questions, but I kind of think that, you know, Hamlin is, you know, they're an investment manager and, you know, they're very adept at being involved in these types of transactions. So I think that if this were a more broad-based limited public offering, where it wasn't going to just one investor, perhaps that there would be more questions and et cetera. But I mean, we're really depending on the fact that, you know, Hamlin is an expert in this field, that this is an investment that they're making the commitment of 81.6 million towards. So.
Yeah, no, point well taken. I understood. Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Hearing none, the motion has been made and seconded to accept staff's recommendation for the financing for LiveWell Alliance. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? Are there any abstentions? Motion carries. Thank you very much. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Okay. Mike, are you going to talk to us about Odin Capital?
Yes. Odeon Capital has requested to be added to the authority's approved managing underwriting's approved list, specifically in connection with the LiveWell Alliance proposed limited public offering. Our policy has been to approve underwriting firms on a rolling basis in between the underwriter approval cycle, which will occur this October. The firm is headquartered in New York. It's been around since 2008. It's a full-service boutique broker-dealer and investment banking firm serving institutional investors and high-net-worth individuals. They're registered with SEC and a member of FINRA and the Securities Investors Protection Corporation. The firm's comprised of 100 professionals and it states it has traded tens of billions of dollars in securities, creating and providing liquidity to a number of unique sectors. The lead banker on Odeon has over 27 years of experience in municipal finance and working for a number of the large investment banking firms. As far as their senior manager experience, over the past 3 years, they were senior manager for 10 transactions, totaling over $600 million, 9 for senior living facilities, and 1 charter school. All 10 of the transactions were non-rated offerings, sold only to institutional investors. And they had 2 recent deals. They served as senior manager for 2 senior living facilities, 1 in New Hampshire and 1 in Washington, 2 both fairly large size transaction. And both of the offerings were non-rated structured, very similar to the proposed LiveWell offering with Hamlin Capital as the purchaser. Since Bob has mentioned, it's the reason they need underwriters in order to obtain CUSIPs every time there's a drawdown on the transaction. So therefore that's the need for the underwriter, but that's pretty much Odeon placing the debt with Hamlin Security. So that a recommendation is to be added to the approved senior underwriting list to serve as senior manager for the LiveWell transaction, mainly based on their experience in non-rated debt and working with the Hamlin Capital.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mike. For the discussion, there heard the description of adding Odeon Capital as an underwriter. Would someone like to make a motion to support that recommendation, then we can open up to questions. Anyone move the?
Sure, I'll make a motion. It's Steve Elbaum.
Thank you, Steve.
I can second it, Sue Martin.
Thank you. We've got a motion. We'll get seconded. We've heard the background for the staff recommendation. Are there any questions for Mike or anyone else on staff?
Peter, it's Daryl. Just one. I want to make sure that I understand correctly that we're adding Odeon to the approved senior underwriter list for this transaction, not in general?
Correct, just for this transaction, because we're doing a full phase RFP in the summer for October approval, so then we can revisit it at that time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Questions? Comments? Okay, motion is made and seconded to
Mike. It's Steve. I may have missed it, but just relative to other underwriters, are there certain key metrics that you look at, and how do they compare to other underwriters that are already approved?
There are some key metrics. I mean, obviously experience. They're pretty limited for just pretty much in the senior living sector. Also, I put in the net excess capital. That used to be a huge metric going back way back when. That pretty much determines how much the firm can underwrite or have to put up cash should the deal not go through. But since this doesn't really have that risk, this is simply placing the transaction with the one investor. So that I don't think that's very relevant for this.
So you mentioned the net excess capital. In other words, it's consistent with the net excess capital, if that would be a factor that it was relevant, that's consistent with other underwriters, or
it would be sufficient
in the market.
It would be on the lower side, but higher than some of our approved senior underwriters.
Okay.
Like I mentioned, they're really not so-called underwriting, taking in their own inventory and then selling it later. I mean, it's just going to be, they're basically acting as a pass-through.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else? Anyone? Okay, motion is made and seconded to appoint or add Odeon Capital as an underwriter. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? Are there any abstentions? Thank you. The motion carries. Okay. Prior to this meeting, we had two committee meetings, the Audit Finance and the Human Resources Committee. I'd like to do a review and both those committee meetings. We'll start with Audit Finance. Susan, would you like to walk us through the actions taken?
Sure. Thanks, Peter. Yeah, so we just met prior to this meeting. In addition to approving the minutes from the May meeting, the committee heard a report from the BLX group, who had been engaged to perform kind of a follow-up internal audit engagement around arbitrage, both procedures and calculations. Their report showed that they find low risk for CHIFA in this area. They had some recommendations for improvement, and either they've already been put into place by the staff or in progress. So at the conclusion of that report, the committee approved the report from that engagement. And then we went on and we heard some detailed information from Cynthia Peoples regarding the fiscal 2023 proposed operating and capital budgets. I think in summary, the operating budget really wasn't a lot of differences from the previous year's budget and where we are on a year-to-date basis against that budget. And the capital budget only had one item of significance on it. I think it was about $320,000, and that is to create and implement a customer portal where all the compliance work that customers have to do and submit will all be in one place. After answering some questions from the committee has approved that proposed, both of those budgets, the proposed operating and capital budgets for fiscal 2023. And those were our two main items of business at that meeting. I don't know, does a full board need to approve the operating capital budgets?
I believe it does, but I will defer to Denise.
Yes, it does. He's head shaking. So if there are any questions, we can certainly answer those, or Cynthia can answer that. Does anybody have any questions or want to add anything further?
Any questions on capital or operating budget for fiscal 23? All right. Be happy to entertain a motion to accept the committee's recommendation for adoption of the budget as presented. Is there a motion? I'll move it. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Mike, thank you for seconding. So the motion has been made and seconded to approve the Audit Finance Committee's recommendation to accept the fiscal 23 capital operating budgets. Are there any questions or comments for Susan or Cynthia or any of the board members who are at the meeting? Questions, comments? All right, hearing none, all those in favor of accepting the recommendation from the Audit Finance Committee on the fiscal 23 capital and operating budget, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? Are there any abstentions? Thank you, the motion carries. Thank you, Susan. The other committee that met prior to the board meeting was the Human Resources Committee chaired by Mike Angelini. Mike, I'll turn it to you for a recap.
Great. Thank you, Peter. The committee reviewed today and acted on two items that the committee is now submitting to the full board for consideration. The first item pertains to the Chief of Money Purchase Pension Plan, a pension plan covering chief employees. Denise Aguilera, General Counsel for Chiefa, provided a brief review and brought the committee's attention to several changes being made to the plan that require an amended and restated plan document. The changes are all ministerial in nature, including some being implemented due to changes in law. Unless there are questions, I will ask Peter to request a motion to approve the amended and restated Chiefa Money Purchase Pension Plan in the corresponding adoption agreement, administrative procedures, summary of plan provisions, and the amended and restated trust.
Thank you, Mike. Someone like to move the acceptance of those documents?
Peter, there's a motion.
Peter, this is Lawrence.
Excuse me, sorry. Peter, it's Denise. There's a resolution at page 105 of the package for approval.
Okay.
Thanks, Denise.
So we would be approving the resolution, correct, Denise?
Correct.
Okay. Would someone like to move adoption or approval of the resolution as presented in the meeting packet?
So move, Lawrence Davis.
Lawrence, I'll second it.
And Peter, I'm sorry, one more item. I forgot to mention there's a small edit that needs to be made on it's on the first page of the trust. It's on page 202 of the package. The word trust needs to be added at the top of the page after the title. So that's just one other edit. Sorry about that.
Well, I have to say, I'm a little disappointed on page 200. No board member caught that.
202, top of page 202. Yeah.
Okay. With that clarification, the motion has been made and seconded to adopt the resolution as presented. Any further questions or comments? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Any abstentions? Thank you. It has been adopted. Thank you, Denise, for your work on that. Okay, thank Mike.
Thank you. The second item performed by the committee today was a review of the FY22 performance of Chiefa's executive director for the purpose of recommending a merit increase to be effective July 1st, 2022. The committee did go into executive session that included an opportunity to understand the impact of the proposed merit increase on Chiefa's FY23 budget, and also a reminder of the FY23 merit program for all Chiefa employees. In executive session, the committee also engaged with Jeanette directly, recognizing Chiefa's many highlights from the year, her contributions as leader, and opportunities to consider to continue Chiefa's strong trend of excellent service. Upon Jeanette's departure from the executive committee session, the committee concluded on a merit increase for the executive director role and ended the session and approved a merit increase in the open meeting itself. Unless there are questions on this item, I'll ask Peter to request a motion to approve the Resources Committee recommendation.
Would we like to go into executive session first to allow other board members to ask questions? Mike, I think maybe we want to move into an executive session.
Okay.
I would move to go into executive session for purposes of discussing the executive director's performance evaluation.
I will second.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed?
Aye.
We'll now move into executive session. Okay, I think we've got everyone. For the record, I'll state that no votes were taken in executive session. The purpose of moving into executive session was for review of the executive director's performance evaluation for fiscal 22. Would someone like to make a motion on the performance evaluation merit increase for the executive director?
It's Mike Angelini, so moved.
All right, someone like to second it?
Second, Sue Martin.
Thank you, Susan. So the motion has been made and seconded to accept the Human Resources Committee merit increase for the executive director per the compensation range in the operating budget. Are there any questions or comments? Discussion? All those in favor of accepting the Human Resources Committee recommendation on the merit increase for the executive director, please say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? Aye. Any abstentions? Thank you very much. Motion carries.
You can smile, Jeanette.
Is there any other business?
Thank you. Brought before much the board? Appreciated.
Any other business for the good of the cause? I just want to remind everyone that we have a health equity forum on June 23rd from 9:30 to 11:30. I believe it's in the conference room of the Hartford Foundation's offices, same building as CHIFA. If you haven't registered, I believe there's gonna be one more email invitation, but if you haven't registered and have the time, I would encourage you to try to be there and support the cause.
So, and actually it's nine to 11, Peter.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had 9:30.
That's my mistake. I misstated it previously.
Oh, you made a mistake? That's after we did your evaluation.
You would like to reconsider the prior motion?
All right, 9 to 11 on the 23rd. Any other business brought before the board?
Move adjournment.
I like that, Daryl. We have a motion to adjourn. Anyone second it?
Second.
All those second. In favor?
Aye.
We are adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thanks, everyone. You.